40 years ago, people could not wait to get out of American cities. Flight to the suburbs was still a common thing, as drugs and crime, or at least the perception of them, scared people away from urban living. The crime rate dropped. So did the flight. And then real estate prices began rising as more people found the cities attractive. Urban living now has an allure it did not have a couple of generations ago, but cities still have their issues. They can be very hard on the environment. Our guest this hour knows the issues of cities now. He lives in New York and can see what cities might be like in the future. Stephen Cohen is the author of The Sustainable City, and it's not like he just started thinking about sustainability. He's the executive director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University in New York, where he's also a professor in the practice of public affairs. Stephen Cohen, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
The idea that cities must lead in sustainability may be counterintuitive to some people. I mean, why there and not in the countryside, closer to nature?
Well, I think the fundamental issue is that there's too many people, and there's not enough land. A few generations ago, you could imagine, you may remember Pete Seeger had 150 acres on the Hudson and was able to, live a self-sufficient life off the grid, and he bought that 150 acres for about $10,000, and I think they sold it for over $100 million.
Wow.
So it's, that's the fundamental problem. When I was growing up, there were 3 billion people on the planet. Now we have 7.5 billion. And so the answer is not going to be to spread out in self-sufficient communities. It's going to be to concentrate people and to build systems so that they have the least possible impact on the surrounding countryside.
The book, The Sustainable City, is organized in three major sections: concepts, cases, and conclusions. We appreciate the alliteration there. before we get into the meat of the book, is there a city on Earth that is even close to sustainable now?
Not really. I mean, I think we're all in transition from the industrial city to the sustainable city. Some cities are further along than others. I think on the West Coast, you're doing better than we are here on the East Coast. But I think we all have a long way to go. I mean, in New York City at the end of World War II, half of the GDP of the city was in clothing manufacture. This was a city that had a lot of factories. We made things here. Now we make fewer than 2% of the GDP of New York City is in clothing manufacture. Believe it or not, we made cars in New York City. Columbia has a building called the Studebaker Building, which was a vertical factory. So, actually, when I was a teenager, I worked in a bicycle factory in Brooklyn. We made bicycles. It's all gone. And it's been replaced by a more service-oriented, information-based set of economic activities. And I think that's part of what's happening in the world between automation and the fact that our demand for information and services has grown. We're finding more and more employment in the service part of the economy. And that provides the potential for cities to become much cleaner than they were in the 1930s, 40s, 50s, and so forth.
In fact, specifically to New York, isn't manufacturing now banned in Manhattan?
It's not bad, but it's very hard to do because the land's so expensive. We have a park called the High Line, which mm-hmm. was a freight train from the docks on the west side of Manhattan to the clothing manufacturers on the west side. And it was built so that the trains could avoid the freight trains could avoid the traffic of the streets. Well, what happened is somebody invented something called containerized shipping, and the docks in New York City were too small. So all of the dock facilities moved to New Jersey to new facilities that had to be built for the trucks and trains and containerized vessels that are now being used to move things from place to place. And we're in a global economy, all of which has made cities play a very different role today than they played in the 20th century.
Is it a case of we can see the future? We know what a sustainability might do. We're just not quite sure how to get there.
I think we can see it, and we're moving in that direction. I mean, the fact is we process much more of our waste than we used to. In New York City, until 1963, we used to burn garbage in incinerators in apartment buildings. I mean, there would be a haze over the city that was banned. We treat our sewage. We now filter our water. People are the air, water, and land in America in 2018 is much cleaner than it was when EPA was started in 1970. And I don't know if people fully understand, we've grown economically tremendously in that period of time, and we've applied technology to make our air and water much cleaner than it was, and we have to just keep doing it.
Well, you mentioned Pete Seeger, and I guess we should bring up him and the river right now, because the right. Hudson River was awful. I remember swimming in the Morton Street Pier around 1970, and it was just some sort of an icky pea soupy green.
Yeah, it was a sewer. I mean, it was basically, we dumped raw sewage into the Hudson until 1984, when we built a sewage treatment plant on the river. It's indescribable what we used to do here. And, you know, we spend money on it, but frankly, the money we spend on, whether it's waste management or air pollution control or filtering our water, returns to us in benefits with health and with increased productivity that are really amazing when you start looking at the numbers. Every dollar we spend on air pollution control brings us $15 of benefits back as a society. It's really the ultimate no-brainer to try to have a cleaner environment.
All right, much more to talk about. It's not just about cleaner environment, but ways in which we don't create as much waste in the first place.
Right.
Among the concepts in sustainability, we'll talk with Stephen Cohen more about his book, The Sustainable City, when we return to the Jefferson Exchange. You're welcome to join us by phone at 800-838-3760 or send your emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Cohen, The Sustainable City, and you in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Stephen Cohen, who leads the Earth Institute at Columbia University in New York. He's a professor in the practice of public affairs there as well. He is thinking about the future, urban future, in a book called The Sustainable City. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Talk about what you'd like to see in a city of the future and what would make it sustainable. 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You do say, wisely so, I think, that sustainability can be defined so broadly as to lose its meaning. So when you say sustainable, Stephen Cohen, what do you mean?
Well, when I think about a sustainable city, I mean one... Oh, a city that uses resources as efficiently as possible, uses renewable resources as much as possible, recycles as much as possible, and has the least possible impact on the environment. And the fact is, human beings have an impact on the environment. We can't avoid it. So the goal is to reduce that impact, so it's the least possible impact. And to also make sure people get to live the way they want to live. I mean, people enjoy... you know, different kinds of consumption, whether it's materials or entertainment or food or whatever, and the city is a place to do that. Cities are also, of course, a really good place to interact with other human beings, and that's another part of the sustainable city.
Are you kind of out in front of things here, or is there an organization or several that has a concept of a sustainable city that you've latched onto?
No, there are many definitions, and I think, you know, we're really at the beginning stages of really trying to understand this new kind of economy and how we're going to navigate it. And I think that there is no single definition that, you know, this is the one that I'm using. I'm focused a lot on the issue of getting off of fossil fuels for obvious reasons.
Sure, and which raises the question, I mean, some of this is accounting and where you allocate things, isn't it? I mean, would a city necessarily be sustainable from the point of construction on through operation, or would it, you have to sort of assume the construction wouldn't be so sustainable, but operations would be?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is the nature of the built environment. I live in a city where we have a lot of old structures, so you can imagine New York being... more renovations and using the materials that are sourced correctly. So so that you're not being destructive of the environment. But, you know, if you're building a new city, then you need new natural resources. But again, you can think about the materials as being materials that are based on finite resources that you're using for the first and only time, or it can be recycled resources, or it can be organic resources, you know, wood and things that you grow. There's more and more plastics that are that we're able to grow from natural organic substances. So I think that's really what we have to be thinking about.
You point out there are three areas to really energize to get to a sustainable city. One is organizational management, two is finance, and three is public policy.
Right.
To the organizational management side, are we talking about different structures than currently exist?
I think part of it is, you know, there needs to be a lot of learning. So in many organizations, and we're seeing this anyway, I mean, you're seeing networks of organizations replacing vertical hierarchies. You're seeing people, you know, what's called the gig economy, working several jobs, not necessarily having a single boss. I think that we're in a more expert-based economy where more and more knowledge is needed to do specific jobs. And I think sometimes that means that people need to work for more than one employer. So the public policy issue there is, how do we make sure that people have health care, and how do we make sure people have other benefits that are necessary in order to survive and thrive in old age? And, you know, one of the nice things about the Affordable Care Act was that your health insurance really was transportable. And I don't know why I'm speaking in the past tense, but
it feels like it's behind us now. Yeah,
but I think those kinds of public policies are important in facilitating that that kind of economic life. But when I'm talking about capacity, I'm mainly talking about people learning how to do things. So, for example, the apartment building I live in just got through New York City. We now have a place for organic waste. It's a special garbage can that seals, and there in that way doesn't attract vermin. But the garbage can gets collected, and it goes to an anaerobic digester, which is a mechanical composting facility, and that creates fertilizer. And that's really what you want to do. You want to move that food waste back into the food system. And we need to. And this is, again, this is maybe 300,000 or 400,000 people in New York out of 8.5 million have this now. But it's starting, and this is the beginning of a really important trend in sustainability.
Stephen Cohen, our guest on The Exchange, his book, The Sustainable City. So congratulations, composting in New York City. I didn't think I'd see the day. when we talk about changes in organizational management, though, are we talking about necessarily changing relationships of voters and taxpayers to the city, too?
Well, I think that you know, you need to have political participation. People at the community level have to have a voice in what gets put in their area. I mean, you're going to, you know, that anaerobic digester means that trucks with food waste have to pull up and drop off their food waste. And it has to be done in a way that the people in the surrounding area find acceptable. And there are ways through design to make that not really be a noxious facility if you do it well. And I think that requires a certain level of civic engagement that we need to have for this to work effectively.
Now, we have some NIMBY questions for later on. For right now, we have a question from Larry in Ashland who asks you to compare the advantages of recycling compared to using less of everything. For instance, recycling plastic bags versus reusable bags.
Yeah, I think, you know, waste reduction is better than recycling. Recycling is better than dumping it into a hole in the ground called a landfill. So there's definitely a hierarchy here, but there are certain things that, you know, people need. And, you know, if I'm, you know, in order for me to move around New York City, I walk a lot and I use the subway. I don't have a car that I throw things in the trunk. That means that if I'm bringing food from place to place, I certainly have the canvas bags, but I might also need something that I can seal the food into. Now, sometimes I have that with me, and sometimes I don't. And if I don't, that's where the plastic comes in. You know, part of what we have to do with all of this is not, we need to make sure people understand that sustainability doesn't mean you have to sit alone in the dark with a candle. You can still live a good, active, engaged life, but we want you to pay attention to what you're doing in terms of its impact on the planet.
So it can't be quite as mindless as it had been, has been up to now.
Right.
For a lot of people.
Right. I think, you know, in New York, the whole attitude is, you know, things have to move too fast here. If you look at the recycling bins on the streets of New York, you know, it's ghastly. I mean, nothing is in the right place. You go to San Francisco, you go to Portland, everything's in the right place. It's like some other species walks on the streets. These are cultural issues that people need to adapt to and learn. And I don't think people live badly in places where they pay attention to where they put their garbage. I think they're a little bit more mindful, and that's part of the change that we're starting to see.
So beyond changing mindsets in degree of difficulty, you say that the changing of infrastructure will be the toughest. And in particular, you start off with the electrical infrastructure. How different does that need to be from what we're using now?
Yeah, we need to we waste a lot of electricity. We waste it in its transmission. We waste it because we don't distribute it. In other words, you can't generate it from your home and send it back to the grid. And as we see electric cars become more common, everybody that has one of those, in a sense, has a storage place for energy. And as battery technology gets better, we're going to see more and more of it. So we need to move to the smart grid. And that's going to take 20, 30, 40 years to build because we're building on top of existing infrastructure. And if you go, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
If you go back to how the original grid was built, it was actually started in New York by Thomas Edison. And they literally went door to door to convince people to add electricity to their home. And at first what they do is they would bring the electricity and say, would you like a porch light? And see, your neighbor has an electric porch light. And so people say, yeah, that'd be a great thing. Once they got onto the house, then how about if we put the electricity inside the house because people were scared, and now you can have a refrigerator and you can have an ice box and all the rest. And so, you know, these things are going to take a long time to do. We're going to probably build a smart grid first with microgrids, which are small smart grids. They're done on a community level, eventually knit them together. That's going to be tricky. And then we also have to get off of fossil fuels. We have to move to particularly solar and probably wind-generated energy and a more electrical-based energy system. And that depends on the invention of better battery technology.
So, Stephen, what makes a smart grid smart? Is it just that it balances demand and supply a little better?
Well, it's computer controlled. In other words, it allows you to, first of all, it allows you to shut the grid down in a section. Like, let's say there's a natural disaster going on, and you've seen a substation go under. What happened in Lower Manhattan after Hurricane Sandy is the whole all of Lower Manhattan lost energy because it spread from substation to substation. The only thing that kept, the only exception to that was NYU's microgrid, because they were able to separate themselves from the larger grid system. So you need to have that kind of decentralized flexibility, and you need computer controls which allow you to send energy when you need it and to not send energy when you don't need it, and so you don't generate it until you need it. And right now we have a lot of trouble doing that.
Right. Stephen Cohen is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the executive director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University in New York. He is also a professor in the practice of public affairs at Columbia and the author of The Sustainable City. We're looking at the future of cities and all the ways in which they can be different from the cities we live in now. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Join us with your thoughts about what a sustainable city would include or what it might not include. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. After energy is water, and I wonder, Stephen, if you're watching the situation in Cape Town closely.
Yeah. They are approaching zero water. Water and food are, you know, biological necessities, and it reminds us that we're biological creatures. It's not that there's less water. I mean, we have the same amount of water on the planet than we've ever had. None of it's left the planet. It's a question of degrading it through pollution and salinization and of not distributing it to where people need it. And that's largely an issue of capital investment in infrastructure. and the use of technology. There's no part of the world that really needs to do without water. When you run out of water, it's because you didn't plan effectively for, you know, any kind of contingency.
Like a drought.
Like a drought. I mean, New York City is probably a very good example. Manhattan had wonderful groundwater. It was completely polluted by the settlement of New York City. And the city founders knew that, so they built a system north of the city, which the city owns and controls, and it's a gravity-fed system, and it works magnificently. But should we ever have a drought where the reservoirs aren't working, we can take water from the rivers and even potentially from the ocean and build a desalinization plant to keep the city with sufficient water. And I think we're going to, particularly with the impact of climate change and the unpredictability of rainfall, we're going to find ourselves needing to build more backup systems and spending more money on this. And, you know, nobody wants to do that if they can avoid it.
The approach to infrastructure, though, I mean, especially in the example you just gave about New York, I mean, New York's been working on that third water tunnel from upstate for how long now?
It took about 50 years to finish it. It's just about finished now. And the story is it's almost funny. I mean, Mike Bloomberg came in as mayor, and somebody said, yeah, all of Manhattan gets all of its water from 100-year-old tunnel that could collapse at any moment. And the story was they built the second water tunnel so that they could close the first one to repair it, but the city grew so fast they'd never been able to close it. So we lose about a third of our water in its transmission. So the third water tunnel was started in the 1950s, and under Bloomberg, they accelerated the construction of it, so it's largely finished. And the goal is eventually to start closing over the next 50 years the other two, one at a time, to repair them. And that's a, you know, most politicians aren't going to do something that will take 20 years that doesn't help them get reelected. And that's part of the problem. You need a long-term perspective for some of these projects.
So as a society, we need to think further down the road than just who's in office now.
Yeah, it's very important. I mean, if you think about it, the Colorado River Project is an example, the Tennessee Valley Authority and rural electrification. America used to do this kind of stuff. We used to build with 20, 30, 50-year horizons, and we just seem to have forgotten how to do it.
We move on to the topic of waste next, and here's where I'll bring in a call from Mark in Fortuna, California. We're talking to Stephen Cohen, the author of The Sustainable City. Hi, Mark.
Hello. So, yeah, I've worked in the medical field a number of years, and there's just a vast amount of waste. And a lot of the waste, you know, I'm not sure it's driven by the fear of spread of disease, which is just certainly a real thing. But I know a lot of places they'll incinerate it as opposed to bury it. You know, there used to be those stories of back east, they'd dump it on the ocean and then wash up on the beaches. And part of sustainability, you know, what are your feelings on the medical waste? And a follow-up would be, you talk about getting off fossil fuels. A lot of people do that, but there's some things we have to derive from fossil fuels. What about people adjusting to the costs that are going to have to rise for those few items that we'll need to keep on the shelf.
All right. Thanks for the questions, Mark. Appreciate that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Okay. So for toxic waste, those kinds of waste, not just medical, but there's a variety of other kinds of waste products. I mean, actually, computer e-waste, the old cell phone batteries and all that, we have to be very careful because of the toxic substances that are inside of them. Fortunately, the volume of that kind of waste is relatively small relative to the total waste stream. And so we do have to think about that kind of waste, mainly trying to contain it and manage it, and where possible, safely mine it. Now, the way that stuff gets mined now is they send it to the developing world and children pull out the valuable metals from it, which is incredibly dangerous and toxic for everybody. But you can imagine a better system where those kinds of substances are mined for reuse. And I think eventually we're probably going to go back to our landfills and mine them for metals and things like that. And I think oil and fossil fuels are a good example. I think 100 years from now, people are going to be astonished that we burned so much of it. These hydrocarbons are really interesting chemicals that can be used in plastics and all sorts of materials that could last for a very long time. In fact, part of the problem is some of it lasts for a long time. But if you did it by design and deliberately, those hydrocarbons could play a very important role in our future. So there are things that you use oil for and hydrocarbons that you'd want to use in the future. What you don't want to do is dig it out of the ground in a way that damages the environment, or drill for it in a way that damages the environment, or burn it so that it creates climate change. I mean, on the other hand, you could manufacture using hydrocarbons in ways that would be very useful for society.
All right. We have more to talk about with Stephen Cohen. His book is The Sustainable City. We'll come back and talk more about what is involved in making a sustainable city. And can we build them on top of the ones that we have now? We'll pursue that issue with you and your phone calls and emails when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are exploring the future in this hour of the exchange, more specifically the urban future, and how we can make places to live that are nicer to the planet than the ones in which we live now. Stephen Cohen is the executive director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University in New York. He's also a professor in the practice of public affairs there. He's written a book called The Sustainable City, which envisions the things we have to change to make our cities sustainable. What are your ideas? What kinds of things do you want to see in the cities of the future? Or what things don't you want to see that we may have in our cities now? Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to continue along with the solid waste issue because we just sort of barely touched on this. You know, we have a particular issue which seems like it's mostly on the West Coast, where a lot of our recyclables are no longer being taken by China. Therefore, it's producing a ripple effect back to curbside recycling here in our part of the world. Is that same sort of thing happening in New York?
It hasn't hit here in the same way that I'm hearing about it there, but you know, you do have to think about the entire system of recycling and how these substances are used. I mean, part of what's happening in China also is that they're now starting to outsource some of their manufacturing. I mean, it's you know, one of the things about economic life in the 21st century is that most of the value-added, the high value-added part of the economy, where most of the money is in services and software, not in manufacturing and hardware. And so now we're starting to see that happen in China. But Africa and Malaysia are, and other parts of Southeast Asia are places where you're still seeing manufacturing. So, but yeah, the recycling industry requires a place to bring things to, and those markets have not been developed the way they need to.
Now, you mentioned in the section of the book of solid waste about how NIMBY politics had stopped a couple of projects in New York. Like what?
Well, we were supposed to build waste-to-energy plants or incinerators in every borough. It had been approved, and then the politics of it stopped it. And so as a result, all the garbage in New York City, once we filled our last landfill in Staten Island, all of it is exported out of the city. And that means now these days we're doing more of it by barge, but a lot of it is still trucked, and so you're basically you know, taking the pollution from one place and using the internal combustion engine to move it to another place, and then very often those other places in Virginia and Georgia, the landfills inevitably create pollution for the surrounding countryside. So that is not a good way to get rid of your garbage.
That's kind of the definition of unsustainable. Yeah.
Right, right. It's very bad. But on the other hand, in America in general, more and more of our waste is treated. At the beginning of the 1960s, we produced less waste per capita, and there were fewer of us, but almost all of it went to landfills. Now, about half of our garbage is treated in one form or another. Either it's recycled or it's burned for energy. And in the burning process, there's much better filtration than there was 20 or 30 years ago.
So very different from the incinerators of the past?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, a country like Japan has no landfills. It's all waste to energy there. And they've, you know, they've even figured out some advanced ways where they transform their garbage chemically. They don't actually incinerate it. They use a process called gasification to change it chemically. So there are a lot of things that can be done with waste products with more imagination. And of course, we can reduce the amount of waste, which we're beginning to see some of that happen.
All right, and that's solid waste and trash. We move on now to a discussion of human waste, and here's where I bring in Skeeter and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Stephen Cohen, the author of The Sustainable City.
Hiya. Thank you for a great program. Can you talk a little bit about composting toilets? They've been around for 40 or 50 years, and I'm just curious why they're not in use a lot more, because they don't really use water. And apparently the material that is in the container for a couple of years can be used for farming later. Also, Paul Ehrlich wrote his book, The Population Bomb, maybe 50 or 60 years ago. And I'm curious why people aren't talking more about population control. I mean, come on, folks. We're going to have about 9 billion people on this planet soon. And well, also, the Chinese capture their methane, and they use it as fuel from their composting. Anyway, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Skeeter.
Sure. Well, let me start with the population, because I think that's, in some ways, the most interesting issue. So we are actually at what is probably going to be peak human population, because with economic development, children have become have moved from becoming economic assets to economic liabilities. When my grandfather came from Russia at the beginning of the 20th century, he was one of a dozen children. You have children, a lot of children, because many died before they became adults, and you also needed them to work the farm and for Social Security because you weren't getting any from the government. They were going to take care of you. In the modern world, children basically cost you money. And so the best form of birth control is how expensive it is to have children and to send them to school and to do all the other things you want to do for your kids. And all over the world, in developed countries, population growth has gone below replacement. Western Europe, Japan, and frankly the U.S. without immigration would be shrinking in population. So, in essence, we've created a culture and a society where population is growing on momentum, but with economic development, will end. And then the issue will be very different. Our economies are built on a kind of growth model, and it's going to have to become more of a sustainability model, particularly as we get to the end of the 21st century. So I think that's one of the more interesting things that's happening now. Now, I should say I have two wonderful daughters who I love very much, but I have to say I never expect to see any return on that investment financially. It's all psychic gratification. But that wasn't the way things were 100 years ago.
That's true. The kids had to work on the farm. To the other question that Skeeter posed about composting toilets, and this gets us into the whole human waste area.
Right. I think, you know, in a large city and in places where you're further removed from where the food is grown, and that's going to become more and more of the way the world's going to work, that may not be the best technology to use. What you really want to do is get to your sewage treatment plants and turn as much of those things into places where human waste is recycled and used for fertilizer. In other words, a single toilet, in a city of 8.5 million, as I have here in New York, is not very practical. And frankly, most of the food we get in New York City, 95% of it comes from further than 200 miles from the city. So you have a problem. How do you get that waste treated and then sent to wherever it has to go? The anaerobic digester is one way to do it, but it's taking it and bringing it to a central facility. I think we can do that with sewage treatment as well, and then you basically create, large streams that allow you to have economies of scale to create that fertilizer.
So the sustainable city, when we get to the topic of food, would have to pretty much create its own food, or at least create its own food largely within a few miles, I would think.
Well, it's interesting to say that. I mean, New York now has a system of green markets, and they're wonderful all over the city. And I, at one point, asked the person running them for the city, why don't we have more of these? These things are great. He said, well, the problem is every farmer within 150 miles of New York is growing everything they can to send to these green markets, and it still only accounts for about 5% of the food in the city. We are in a global industrial food economy, and that's just the way it's going to be from now on. So I don't think we're going to see that change. Now, you could have. We have a, I have a colleague, Dixon DePommier, who has designed something called a vertical farm. And you can imagine skyscrapers that are closed-system farms. And that could happen over time as the technology develops. But for the foreseeable future, we're going to be in a global food market, and a lot of food is going to be transported over long distances. And so the question is, how do we make sure that that transport is based on renewable energy instead of fossil fuels?
We have, as we move on to land use and open space, Mike in Medford sent in an email. He says, here in Medford, our planners seem to be obsessed with building strip malls. Almost every natural part of the city has been paved over with football field-sized parking lots and cheaply constructed buildings. Instead of building up, we are destroying any semblance of a healthy urban ecosystem and the ecosystem and the natural beauty of the region. That, again, from Mike in Medford.
Well, you know, that's, you know, and we saw this in Houston, where they covered over so much of the permeable surface that the flooding from the hurricanes this fall were particularly devastating. But on a worldwide basis, we are seeing more concentration. And one of the things that I was looking at was repurposing old urban spaces that were industrial as parks. So in Seattle, you have the Gas Works Park. In New York, we have the High Line. D.C. has a park as well that by the canal that used to be industrial. So I think we're going to see more repurposing of those places. And it's very important because, you know, if you live in a city, you spend most of your time indoors. And we have to build outdoor public spaces. We have to build an appreciation of nature. We have to get people from cities out into the countryside to build the value of protecting those natural areas. So those are all important aspects of a sustainable city, building an understanding of the value of nature, because otherwise, you know, as time goes on, people will, you know, they'll ski in a simulation and they won't actually get up and see a mountain.
Well, which raises a question, and I don't say this just to be argumentative and because I like railroads, but when you think about things like the High Line, I mean, picking up freight that came off of ships right there on the west side of Manhattan and then would be delivered potentially, you know, within a few miles of there, sounds like that might have actually been more sustainable than having all the shipping terminals in New Jersey and these container trains moving across the country.
Yeah. The difficulty was, you know, we now have an economy where all of the, you know, if you buy a car, say you buy a Honda and it's been made in Kentucky, it's assembled from parts made in 70 countries. They use containerized shipping. They track it with barcodes and GPS, and all that stuff shows up in Kentucky just as it needs to be manufactured. And so that is that's the modern industrial system. Now, there are, increasing use of freight trains and freight ships, but also lots and lots of trucks. We can see them on the highways. And so that's an issue. I mean, how do we move from the current system to one that has, you know, greater, at least renewable resource bases? So to me, in this country, because it's so spread out and there's so much individual transportation, the key is moving from the internal combustion engine to an electric motor that is cheaper and more efficient and more powerful and reliable than the internal combustion engine. And I think we're starting to see the beginnings of that right now. And so when you have that, then you have less of the issue of fossil fuel use through diesel trains and trucks.
Now, as for the transportation of people, I mean, how do you overcome the view that I like my car and my personal space in it, or the only poor people who got too many DUIs ride the bus, and other
right.
variations you probably heard?
Yeah. Well, you know, this is the difference between New York and other parts of the country. Most of our greenhouse gases come from our buildings. Very few of it, little of it comes from transportation. Most of our transportation is in our subway system. That's the biggest single place that we move around the city on, and that's run by electricity. So Part of that is a cultural change, trying to build mass transit. But I think in some parts of the country, you're never going to get there. In other words, we've built a society where people are spread out. We are seeing some concentration in small towns, and young people are getting tired of sitting in traffic jams and all of that. But I think that the key for most of America is going to be personal transport, but that it's electric and that electricity is coming from renewable sources. That's going to be the way most of America moves around. But I also think you're seeing young people deciding not to own cars. They'd rather be driven around in an Uber. You're seeing the emergence of a sharing economy. When I was growing up, you had a car so you could show it off in front of your friends.
Right.
Now, you show off the experiences of the places you've been, as opposed to how snazzy your car is.
Just a few seconds left, Stephen. Do we know enough now for a sustainable city, or is this like the thinking that, the technology to help us with climate change is just around the corner?
We know a lot. We know enough to make the cities cleaner and safer than they used to be, but we have a lot to learn.
Indeed we do. The book is called The Sustainable City. It's by Stephen Cohen. He teaches at Columbia University in New York and is the executive director of the Earth Institute based there as well. Thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.